Hawaii recently wrestled with three big public health scares linked to mosquitoes, bad scallops, and bad seaweed. Infectious disease outbreaks are unpredictable, but our response to it can go a long way with protecting public health. A legislative audit uncovered weaknesses in record-keeping and review of the state's response to the outbreaks. This morning, State Health Director Dr. Virginia Ginny Pressler joins us live. Welcome.
Aloha, Catherine.
Can you share with us, do the problems boil down to just being short-staffed?
No, I think that, we were aware of some of these issues long before the audit was done. The problems are that this preparedness branch was initially put under the Disease Outbreak Control Division, which includes disease investigation and immunization branches. And the reason it was there initially, it was after the 9/11 attacks and the concerns about biohazards and that kind of thing. So it made sense to put resources under the Disease Outbreak Control Division. And what's happened since then is we have many other types of hazards in addition to infectious disease outbreaks. We have nuclear threats. We have radiation threats. We have threats of spills of all kinds, whether it be petroleum or sewage or whatever. And so many of the disasters that we need to respond to go way beyond the Disease Outbreak Control Division's capabilities.
Now, the audit flagged that the department didn't follow its own protocols in some instances and has inconsistent procedures for record keeping.
Yeah, and I think that that is a bit of a misstatement. We certainly appreciate the auditor's report because it's always helpful to have an outside, external, independent assessment of the work that we do. It wasn't that we didn't have protocols and all in place. What happened was because the dengue fever outbreak was such a huge effort and we were just barely recovering from that, we had had several big meetings to talk about what we could have done better, but it hadn't all been documented before the hepatitis outbreak hit us, and then on top of that was the salmonella. So when you're dealing with limited resources and you're fighting a fire, you need to put out the fire before you worry about the paperwork. And in this case, the paperwork just hadn't been completed as far as the documentation of the debriefings and the things that we've learned and could do better the next time around.
And this isn't the first time that we've had the dengue outbreak. And I recall many years ago that really the staff was working, I think, around the clock trying to track down these cases and doing the investigations. And a lot of times, a lot of their work goes, I think, unrecognized. People don't realize what they're doing behind the scenes.
These investigations are really complicated. I mean, it starts with having a physician recognize a patient, getting a lab test. So we first find out from the laboratory or from a physician's office. And if we may have nothing more than a post office address or a phone number, and for our investigators to actually get in touch with the individual and family involved, sometimes it's quite a struggle because some of these people don't want to be talking to a government official. They're afraid. They shouldn't be because our interest is strictly in the public health area. But narcotics can be involved, immigration issues. So sometimes these individuals and families aren't going to answer the phone. They're not going to answer the door. And it makes it extremely difficult for our investigators to get all the information they need to complete their work. Very time intensive.
And you mentioned that while you were doing the dengue outbreak, then you had to deal with the Hep A scare, which really was very involved.
That's right. And all of these outbreaks, the reason that we are reorganizing this preparedness branch to move it to an office under the director is because it almost always impacts other areas of the department as well as the counties, the communities, civil defense, other departments such as Department of Agriculture, Department of Land and Natural Resources, the University of Hawaii Tropical Agriculture. We work with all of these partners, and so we recognized early on that we need to reorganize. We're going to have the existing resources, but put them under the director's office so that we can make sure that we're making better use of the entire department, as well as our sister departments and our community partners.
Will you be asking for any additional staff this legislative session?
No, this will be a budget-neutral movement of the existing branch to an office under the director, the same positions, same people for the most part. We do have some empty positions, so I'm going to be recruiting a new chief for the Office of All Hazards Preparedness, and that will be both an internal and external recruitment. We have been asking for a number of years for additional resources in our communications office, and we did succeed this year in getting into the governor's budget an additional information specialist, which would allow us to do a better job of keeping our website up to date and more user-friendly so that we can use that as a resource to get out to the public in a timely manner with all kinds of information.
Okay, but those jobs haven't been posted yet?
No, not yet. They will be soon.
Okay. And then anything else going forward, or is anything that you want to underscore to the public that the changes that you made are going to make us more able to respond in the future?
Yes. You know, our major objective is looking after the public health, and we do recognize the importance of documenting all of these efforts, and that's the only way an outsider can know what was actually done necessarily. But we also recognize the hard work of our staff. The people in the disease outbreak control division worked their heart and soul into this, and we had to mobilize resources from around the entire state in order to address the dengue fever outbreak on Hawaii Island. And so we have nothing but gratitude to not only everyone in that department, but also in other areas of the state that helped rally to the cause to help improve this.
The audit did flag the issue of institutional memory and the need to document so that the department isn't repeating the same mistakes.
Yes, absolutely. And we are totally in agreement with that. We do have guidelines already, both they continue to be revised in order to incorporate input from program staff and our CDC colleagues and other partners after each outbreak. And we had done that after the dengue, but I guess it hadn't been, even though we'd had meetings with including the mayor and civil defense and governor to debrief after the dengue outbreak, I guess that hadn't all been documented in writing before they got hit with the next epidemic.
So we're going into 2018, or we are in 2018. Anything else that you want to underscore going forward? Hopefully your staff is re-energized.
Yes. Well, I want to underscore the hard work that our staff does do and that we need the public's support when we have these kinds of outbreaks. We do our best to educate and get the word out, and we need the community to be involved in a positive sense to help us get control of disease outbreaks, whether that means getting immunizations, whether it means coming forth if you're sick and making sure that we have the information we need. We need to know if someone's traveled, where they work, where they play, where they live, where they worship, where their connections are, so that we know how to really fully investigate a disease outbreak.
Well, hopefully after these three outbreaks that people will have this top of mind.
Well, now it's mumps, so there's always something. It never ends.
That's right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine.
Dr. Ginny Pressler, whose family's roots are in Maui, is the state's health director. Before taking the position, she served as executive vice president of Hawaii Pacific Health. She'd worked at the Department of Health previously as a deputy director and also worked as a surgeon.
I'm Marco Werman. The world is all about the connections between life in America and life way beyond our borders.
America united people of different languages and different races, different religions, who had nothing in common under the idea of America. It's one of the most sort of great contemporary projects of creating a new identity. So think of Ukraine that way.
Lots to think about on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, what astronomers can learn from deep space. But first, your quiz.
We just heard how Hawaii's Department of Health deals with threats to public well-being in the modern era. But in today's backyard quiz, we're looking at how a threat to public health was dealt with in days past. At the time, the incident in question was one of the most devastating events in modern Hawaii. It started in the Chinatown district of Honolulu. The Black Plague of 1900 marked the first time cases of bubonic plague were reported in Hawaii, and the outbreak claimed numerous lives before it was eradicated. To combat these outbreaks, the Board of Health used military guards to enforce a quarantine zone around the Kaka'ako area. Schools were closed, and passengers from incoming sea vessels were isolated. But this alone was not enough to keep the disease from spreading. Ultimately, a far more strident approach stopped it. To answer today's quiz, tell us what action was undertaken. How did Hawaii's Board of Health ultimately rid Oahu of the bubonic plague in 1900? If finding the answer is giving you fever and chills, no worries. We'll tell you a little later. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Henry Kupono. If you like today's music, find a playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
At its best, science fiction is a kind of partner to science fact, building on what we know to allow us to dream about what is possible. As astronomers continue to reach into deep space and gain new knowledge about the origins of the universe and even where its borders might be, science fiction writers are right there with them. Hilton Lewis is the director of the W.M. Keck Observatory on the summit of Mauna Kea. He's bringing a speaker to Hawaii who has worked at the intersection of science fact and fiction, 2017 Nobel Prize laureate Kip Thorne, and he's on the line to tell us about it. Hilton, good morning.
Good morning to you, Chris.
You know, I was wondering how many astronomers today were maybe drawn into their field by science fiction. Did you get excited by science fiction when you were a kid?
You know, I would guess that every single one had some connection with science fiction. And yes, certainly I was fascinated by it. But I have to tell you, modern science is even more amazing than the science fiction we read about.
That's what it. That's the way it seems, especially as you get deeper and deeper into space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the things that we take for granted today, you know, black holes, for example, they were barely theories when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And they certainly were the subject of a lot of science fiction.
What is a black hole, while we're on the subject?
Well, it's a extreme bending of space-time, and it's so extreme, and its gravity is so strong that not even light can escape from it. So basically, you have a location in space that appears completely black.
As you said, the bending of space-time, not just space, not just time, but space-time as a unit.
That's correct. The big realization that Einstein brought to us was that space and time are inextricably linked. And so in the vicinity of a black hole, which forms when a massive star collapses, both time is slowed down tremendously and space is warped to the point, as I said, where light itself cannot escape, and nor can anything else.
And isn't that warping that something that Einstein postulated long before it was proven? Is that an accurate description?
That's right. I mean, Einstein was the first person to come up with an actual explanation of what gravity is. Newton explained how it worked, but didn't have a real understanding of what it is. And so Einstein came up with this postulate that it was this warping of space and time, mm-hmm. that resulted, that we experienced as gravity.
That whole idea of warping of space and time, it's the kind of amazing intellectual leap that Einstein, among others, has been able to make. But it fascinates me that Einstein, for example, worked very much from his imagination as much as he did from calculation. Yeah,
I think so. You know, I've read that the calculational aspect, you know, the equations, that's the way you understand what you're thinking about, but that doesn't actually give you the fundamental insight. And this is true of all of physics, you know, quantum mechanics, relativity. You really have to have an incredible imagination to be able to come up with a theory in the first place. And then the calculation links it to what you actually see in the real world, to the experimental evidence.
The whole idea of use of the imagination kind of leads us back to science fiction, doesn't it, in the sense that, in part, a scientist kind of needs to dream a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I think, the picture or the image that people have of scientists scrawling equations on blackboards and walking around in lab coats is actually very different. Science itself is this intensely human experience. You know, it's full of big egos, and, some people have to die before science can advance. So it's just like any other field, you know, competition, excitement, dreaming. And in the end, of course, but it's very disciplined. It has a way of reviewing its results, and everything has to be borne out by experimental evidence. And I think that's the amazing thing about something like black holes. I mean, you could speculate about them, but in fact, the actual evidence of our own eyes and our own instrumentation shows us that they're right description of what's happening in nature.
At the Keck, you've got an almost unparalleled ability to look far away into deep, deep space. And by doing so, you're looking into the far distant past, aren't you?
That's right. I mean, light travels at a finite speed. And so the farther away something is, the longer it takes for light from that object to reach your eyes. And in fact, the most distant objects we view at Keck, light has been traveling across the universe for over 13 billion years. You know, the Earth is only 5 billion years old. So that's a tremendous look back in time. You're seeing things as they were 13 billion years ago.
It also, conversely, it makes it impossible to know if those things still exist, right?
Oh, well, now we're getting into philosophy.
Yes, we are.
of course, we know things like the ages of stars by studying them. And so many of the things we observe today have long since, if it's a star, it will have exhausted its fuel and maybe collapsed into a black hole or a neutron star or something like that. So some of the things we see actually no longer exist.
Well, that intersection of science and philosophy that you just mentioned, that's really what fires the great science fiction writers who seem to almost move in and out of the world of science fact. I'm thinking of people like Isaac Asimov's Arthur C. Clarke, where in some ways hasn't the work kind of informed real science?
Yeah, there's a feedback loop. I think great science fiction writers can dream in ways that, well, first of all, inspire future scientists, and also can illuminate possibilities. But I wouldn't think that science is actually directly driven by science fiction. It's perhaps some technology a little bit, but the reality is it's more an inspiration than an actual direction. I wouldn't claim that anything Arthur C. Clarke ever wrote resulted in an actual science discovery.
More in the but as you said, as a source of inspiration, and I think one of the things that you're emphasizing this morning is just the role of imagination, of dreaming, allowing your mind to go freely into speculation about the universe.
That's right. It's a license in a way. I think what you're seeing in modern science is very much the same as you see in many fields of human endeavor. There's this cross-connection between culture and philosophy and language and science. It's part of the whole human experience. It's what enriches us, and it's what actually makes us human. And underlying all of this, regardless of the field you're talking about, is this intense curiosity that really defines us as a species.
It worries me sometimes that maybe young people whose inclination is toward the imagination and the arts might not readily embrace science, maybe not understanding the role that imagination plays in science like yours.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the richness of our environment actually probably will overcome that. I mean, people see fantastic movies that depict science and science fiction. They see the adventure that we all experience when NASA launches a probe or people go up in spacecraft. So I think there are many ways to keep the young people engaged in the excitement and the thrill of science, actually. So I'm a little more optimistic than you are.
Well, I'm not that pessimistic. I certainly think that when you hear of a real advance, a discovery being made, it has to be incredibly exciting.
That's right, and of course they are. I think perhaps the bigger challenge is how do we not how do we attract people to science, but how do we actually do the hard work that results in people going into STEM fields? And of course, science is only one manifestation of pure science is only one manifestation of this area. So I think the challenges in our schools, the challenges in exposing our kids to these opportunities, and that's actually something that we at Keck believe a great deal in, because we want to give back to the community. You know, we recognize our fundamental support comes from people in our community, across the nation, across the world, and so it's a very important part of our mission to give back. And the way of giving back is, of course, to excite young minds.
Well, let's hope that process continues. And thanks very much for talking with us. Hilton Lewis is the director of the W.M. Keck Observatory on the summit of Mauna Kea. It will present a free astronomy talk by theoretical astrophysicist Dr. Kip Thorne, executive producer of the film Interstellar and a recipient of the 2017 Nobel Prize in Physics, to describe how he helped turn science fact into science fiction. That public talk will be held this Friday, January 5th, at the Mount Lani Bay Hotel.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Turns out the small businesses impacted by construction along the rail route aren't seeing the help they had hoped to see from the city. On the line today, Civil Beat's Natanya Friedheim. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So what prompted you to take a closer look at this issue?
Well, I attended the April City Council Budget Committee meeting, where the council decided to add a line item into the budget that says, properties affected by rail construction can have this opportunity to apply for $2 million in property tax breaks. And it's sort of in the back of my mind, I always wondered, well, what happened to that? And there was a particularly one testifier at the meeting who claimed that the effects of construction had blocked access to her restaurant. And as a result, 7 months after construction started, or I think it was 11 months, she had to close her restaurant. So I decided to look in, it's been 6 months or 7 months of the fiscal year. And I wanted to know if anything had been done with that that opportunity for businesses.
And so what was the upshot?
So the upshot, I'm sorry, but like, what do you mean when you say upshot?
Well, if the city council was hoping to provide some relief to businesses along that area, it obviously wasn't working.
Right. So what ended up happening with the money is the council said, okay, the city's Department of Budget and Fiscal Service needs to figure out a way to distribute this these funds. And in fact, the tax breaks don't actually give the Department of Budget and Fiscal Services cash to hand out to these businesses, right? It's a It's an opportunity for businesses to pay less, or landowners to pay less on their taxes. So a couple things came up. First, the administration opposes this method of using tax breaks to subsidize businesses. So as Councilmember Joey Manahan put it, the department wasn't very keen on moving on this line item. And then another issue was that even if they did give property tax breaks to the landowner, a lot of businesses that lease the property wouldn't necessarily see any benefit from that. I spoke with one business owner of a restaurant in Waipahu, famous for their deep-fried manapua, who said, you know, he doesn't imagine any landlord would actually let that benefit trickle down to the business leasing the property and the employees. So that was another issue. And there's also no mechanism that we have in Honolulu to allow businesses to apply for the funds. So like other cities, Los Angeles, Seattle once had a program that actually distributed grants to businesses. And there are certain criteria businesses have to follow. They have to be a small business, which means under 25 employees, and they have to prove revenue losses. Right. Honolulu doesn't currently have that kind of system.
Well, it sounds like the city really needs to tweak what they're doing. But thank you for joining us. That was reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim with today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, from healthcare to food production to renewable energy, how innovators are shaking up the status quo to change the world. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
Protected seabirds and endangered turtles are the winners of a recent appeals court decision. The original lawsuit was filed by Earth Justice on behalf of the Center of Biological Diversity and the Turtle Island Restoration Project. The groups describe the problem like this. The sword fishing industry uses lines up to 60 miles long and with nearly 1,000 baited hooks, leatherback and loggerhead sea turtles, as well as migratory birds like the black-footed or Laysan albatrosses, often get caught up and die. The group sued the federal agencies, saying that they didn't do enough to protect the marine species by allowing the fishing industry to double its kill of turtles and birds. Joining us now live in the studio is Earth Justice Paul Achitoff. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us, what do you think will happen with this reversal of the lower court's ruling?
Well, I assume that the fishery will continue to want to kill more turtles, and so they will go back to the National Marine Fisheries Service and say, do whatever you have to do to let us do that. That's the way that they do business. And the Fisheries Service may or may not do exactly what the fishermen want them to do, but generally they do. They bend over backwards to do analyses that will justify whatever the longliners want, which is why we have to keep suing them. In this case, I assume they will do another analysis that will appear to justify killing more turtles, and we will have to look at it and, if appropriate, sue again.
Now, this is not the first time that you've taken up this issue, and you mentioned that there are studies that they can do, but you don't believe that they're doing these studies the right way.
Well, it's not so much a question of studies. It's a question of methods that exist let's separate out here the birds and the turtles, because they're really two separate issues legally and factually. With respect to the turtles, there's a legal way to do the analysis that the Fisheries Service consistently refuses to do. And we've been suing them for 20 years over this. And we finally gotten the decision that we want, which says, look, you cannot keep justifying raising the number of turtles that you allow the fishery to kill simply by saying other fisheries around the world are killing more of them, which is basically what the Fisheries Service and the longliners keep saying. That's not the way the law works, and for good reason. Otherwise, everyone would be allowed to do whatever they want by pointing to other people and saying, well, someone else is doing it too, or someone else is a worse offender than I am, so the law shouldn't apply to me. And that obviously doesn't work. With respect to the birds, the problem is that the fishermen refuse to adopt methods that have been very well studied, that have been proven to drastically reduce the number of albatross and other seabirds that are caught on these lines. They don't want to do it because they find it inconvenient. They don't want to be bothered. But the law says you cannot simply kill birds and say, well, I didn't mean to do it, when everyone knows that this is what is going to happen with the methods that you're using.
And tell us, because the new administration, the Trump administration, has taken kind of a different take on it, what's your fear going forward, how they will view this decision?
I'm not really afraid of the Trump administration. I'm hoping we're going to be seeing an end to it soon enough. But in any event, the problem here is that about a year ago, the Department of Interior solicitor issued an opinion, a very lengthy and very well-written opinion, that concluded that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act does in fact do what many courts have already held, which is prohibit what's known as incidental migratory bird killing. In other words, various industries kill birds. It's not what they're intending to do, but it happens because they don't take appropriate measures to prevent it. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has many times criminally prosecuted industries because of this, and said, you need to do better. And that's the only way that they will do better. And the industries have many times argued to courts, well, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act is only designed to prevent intentional killing like hunting and poaching, not what we do. And the courts have almost uniformly said that's not true. That's not what Congress intended. It is prohibited. And as soon as the Trump administration came in about a year ago, they withdrew a solicitor's opinion that had explained in great detail why that is the law. And they went out and they hired from the Koch brothers, one of their highest paid employees, who has now written an extremely industry friendly version of what the law supposedly says, that says, nope. All the courts that have said otherwise are wrong. In fact, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act does not prohibit incidental take. So, we'll see where that goes. I don't expect it's going to go very far because, as I say, the courts have already concluded otherwise over and over again.
But is it your understanding that the Trump administration just won't prosecute?
I expect that they will not prosecute. But that doesn't mean that citizens such as the groups that I represent cannot take legal action against those who are violating the law.
And so, for a practical matter, what happens? So you had this appeals ruling. What happens to their permits, and what happens to the take?
Well, with respect to the birds, the Fish and Wildlife Service had issued this permit saying, or essentially giving you permission to kill however many birds you happen to kill, as though the Migratory Bird Treaty Act really doesn't exist. And that's what we challenged in court. The court said that's illegal. And I would say that that means that this permit is of no legal effect. So essentially now, the industry and the fishery service that authorizes that industry are going to have to look to this opinion, which, as I say, I don't believe most courts will uphold, that they're allowed to do what they're doing with or without a permit. They don't even need a permit. So we're unfortunately going to have to probably go back to court and say, look, you're still violating the law regardless of this bogus opinion from this, former Koch brothers employee, and you're going to have to comply with the law, which in effect means you're going to have to use some of these methods that we all know exist, that have been extensively studied, that will reduce the impacts of what you're doing.
So you basically think there'll be some foot dragging?
There's been foot dragging for many years. I'm sure that they will have to be dragged into court again.
And as far as the studies, the methods that they're using, are they long and drawn out too? Those counts?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
So as far as the methods that they use to study the taking of these?
Well, the methods that if we're talking about the, again, with respect to the birds, the methods to reduce the catch of birds are very well known. It's just the industry refuses to adopt them. With respect to the turtles, if they do the studies, properly to analyze the impact of what the longline industry is doing to these endangered animals, I think that the proper result is to say you cannot keep killing them because they are going extinct. I mean, their own models show that these species are declining to an alarming degree, and they are listed as endangered for a reason. And you cannot keep killing them and then look in the other direction and say, oh, well, other people are doing it too.
Okay. We'll see what happens going forward. Paul Agitoff is the managing attorney for the Mid-Pacific Office of Earth Justice, a national nonprofit environmental law firm that's been working in Hawaii for over almost 30 years. It sued the National Marine Fisheries and Fish and Wildlife Service. Lawyers for NOAA's National Marine Fisheries and the longlining industry are still reviewing the decision. Earlier in the program, we asked you about Hawaii's Black Plague of 1900. The cases of the bubonic plague were first reported in December of 1899, but it wasn't until the death toll reached several dozen that the Hawaii Board of Health decided to act. In order to prevent the illness from spreading, the board instituted a quarantine of the Chinatown area, closed schools, and isolated passengers from recently docked ships. But these measures weren't able to fully eradicate the plague. For today's backyard quiz, we wanted to know how the Board of Health was finally able to rid Hawaii of the disease once and for all. And the answer was called in by Ken Cook of Kailua, setting Chinatown on fire. More specifically, the Board of Health targeted contaminated buildings with what they referred to as controlled burns in order to erase traces of the plague. The deliberately staged fires proved much harder to contain than originally planned and ultimately destroyed nearly 38 acres of land in total. Despite the unexpected destruction, the fires were still successful at ending the outbreak of plague in Honolulu. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's new Career Center, helping students to explore careers, understand education requirements, and get localized data on salary and jobs. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
What does memory look like? So many of the images we conjure up in our minds are altered in some way, by wishful thinking or just by the passage of time. Taylor Johnson is an artist and printmaker whose new exhibit is called The Memory Of. It uses found images to explore the ways we alter our memories to suit ourselves and challenges us to think again about the images from our lives that we have chosen to preserve. We spoke earlier this morning about the ideas behind her show.
I think it came from having so much distance from my extended family,
mm-hmm.
and growing up on Maui, and just seeing like how connected the rest of my family in Wisconsin and New York are with each other. I felt like I was really missing out on something. And So in a way, I'm kind of recreating that memory from a distance and like trying to like form that connection with them. And I think it has worked, but at the same time, it's falsified.
In the absence of that family album in the musty old attic with pictures going back centuries, you kind of created that, sounds like.
Yeah. And I'm really interested in like how it's become falsified in that process and just how nostalgia is that. It's just like a romanticization of memory for people. And every time you're accessing that memory, you're changing it.
That's just the way memory works, huh?
Yep. And it's interesting to see like how that works just on like a national scale as well. Like you hear things like Make America Great Again, and you wonder what that is really rooted in. And you look back to the times that were glorifying and like wondering if it's as great as it is now.
Whenever we talk about memory, we think about memory. We think about how we maybe sugarcoat our memories, paper over the things that we don't want to think about so much and bring up the things we do.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I read that was interesting in one of my ethics and photography courses was it was focusing on family photos and how just this attempt to show everything that you're not and like cover up the aspects of your life that maybe aren't so sugar-coated. Like these perfect photos might show more of like what someone's trying to cover up versus what they actually are.
And so many family photographs are very staged. They're done in studios. If you go back a century or more, there's a lot of very formal family photos that you see, right?
Yeah, exactly. Most of the ones that I use are from the 40s or 50s. So it's like a very utopic time period where everybody's like taking pictures of their perfect houses and they're all grouped up in these little family photos and everything just seems so perfect. And I'm actually more interested in the photos that got discarded in that process, like the ones that don't make it into the family albums.
How do you go about finding those?
A number of ways. Some of them I have gotten from family members. And others, most of them are actually from flea markets, or I'll order them off of eBay. And I just think it's interesting to work with these images that were discarded by other families, like rather than kept, and they're just being sold off, which seems like a really bizarre thing nowadays. Like if you were just selling off your family photos nowadays, it would seem very strange.
It would, because you would think that the interest would only be for the family itself.
Yeah, exactly. And now when I install, I usually do these installations with a variety of the prints and the photographs. And when people find out that they aren't actually my family, they feel kind of betrayed, I found. And like they think that I am lying to them.
As if you've done something dishonest.
Yeah, exactly.
In evoking that memory.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of the interesting part of it, is that like you follow this trail of memory, like even if it isn't your own.
Perhaps that disturbance that people get is a feeling that you've tampered with something that they'd rather not be tampered with. That you know, their own idea of memory, sugar-coated though it may be, is something they don't want messed with.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I started out. Like for me personally, it was a way to like form this memory with my family, and then along the way I'm realizing that it's extremely falsified, and that turned out to be a much more interesting idea, I think, than just letting myself think that that's what it was, that it really was.
So in a way, your whole idea of what memory is changed in the course of your work.
Yeah. I mean, it started out as a personal project, and then it turned into this thing where it's like, this is how we all deal with memory. Like, we would rather remember the good and, like, eradicate the bad parts of the memories.
It's probably kind of a healthy thing in us that makes us want to remember the good.
Oh, of course. Like, I don't think we would be able to function if we only remembered the bad parts of the memories. I just think it's really interesting that every time we reaccess that memory, it's getting destroyed more and more.
The challenge for you, then, is to translate that into an image.
Yeah.
So idea to image is quite a pathway.
Yeah. So most of the images that I use come from the old family photos, and it's focused mostly on the dwellings because I think that a lot of our memory comes from just where we grew up and, like, shelters. And so that's mostly what I do, but I'm really interested in showing how they are breaking down with time and how that corresponds to memory. And so I've been really interested in seeing, like, these old structures, like, going around upstate New York and just seeing, like, these huge monolithic barns that are still standing, but you can tell, like, time has taken its toll.
And yet if you were to, say, have a memory of a family home, you might easily think of that, say, over a century or more old, you might easily think of that family home as a big, beautiful house, more big, more beautiful than it actually was.
Yeah, exactly.
So by showing it maybe overgrown with weeds or needing a coat of paint, what kind of things, you know, what does that challenge in us?
I think it makes it hard to re-access the same spaces again, to know that you're not going into the same space that you did when you were a kid. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned, like, the scale of it, like how it seems so much bigger.
Well, when you're a little kid, a small house is a big house.
Yeah. And in my work, I like to work extremely tiny, especially because it's, like, a very time-consuming process for me. Mm-hmm. I have to work fairly tiny, but also I like being able to draw you into this, like, tiny space but not really be invited into it because, you know, it's overgrown, it's closed up, you can't access that anymore.
What kind of ideas or images would you like people to leave your exhibit with? The exhibit's called The Memory Of.
Mm-hmm.
As I walk out, what would you like me to be reflecting upon?
Well, I think it's interesting just to look at your own personal memories and, I don't know, maybe understand if you are romanticizing them the same way. I mean, I think everybody is.
And should I feel okay about romanticizing those memories? Should it disturb me?
Yeah, I mean, I still do it. It's like an ongoing process. Like, I still look back at, you know, being in Wisconsin as a kid, and that's highly romanticized for me. And I think that's okay. I just think on, like, a bigger level, when people try to use nostalgia to invoke things in people,
mm-hmm.
and, like, push them a certain way, I think it's important to know that that's happening.
Taylor Johnson is a Hawaii-based artist and printmaker whose exhibit is called The Memory Of. It runs through March 31st at Brew Bar in downtown Honolulu with an opening reception this Friday at 5 p.m. To learn more, you can visit the Conversation page on Facebook.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting As One, A Journey of Transformation, January 11th through the 16th at the Aloha Tower Pier 10 Cruise Ship Terminal, hawaiioperatheater.org.
There are always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and that's where we count on Morning Edition host Derek Malama to keep track of them for us. He looks at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And Happy New Year.
Happy
Derek.
New Year to you too, Chris.
Yeah.
Yes.
We've always got to say that the first time we see each other after the year has changed.
Right.
Even if it's
I'll
April.
That next year. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, there's a Japanese temple in Nuuanu giving out blessings for the new year.
Yes, and tomorrow is the last day that Izumo Taishakyo Mission will offer a traditional Japanese blessings for health and good luck in this new year. Amulets or omomori are available for purchase as well. The temple is located at 215 North Kukui Street near downtown Honolulu.
And in Hawaii Island, there's a pretty active arts community.
Yes. In Hilo, there's an art exhibit highlighting the top artists of the Big Island. It's called Eclectic Diversity, and many of the works featured are in the permanent collection of the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts and are also in private collections around the world. 11 artists are showcased in this display. It's called Eclectic Diversity. It's in Hilo's Wailoa Center through January 25th.
And you know, if you call something eclectic diversity, just about anything can fit into that.
Exactly. So people would want to see it now.
Pretty good catch-all title.
Right.
Tomorrow, the guitarist and singer from a Colorado jam band performs at Blue Note Hawaii.
His name is Vince Herman. He's the founding member of the Boulder Group Leftover Salmon, a progressive bluegrass jam band, sort of like, you know, the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
And he's in town for two performances at 6:30 and 9 p.m. on Wednesday in Blue Note, Hawaii.
Leftover Salmon.
Right.
Food for thought.
Oh, good one, yes.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Alzheimer's disease, what we know about how the disease attacks the brain and destroys memory, and what researchers are investigating that might delay its onset and reduce the damage it causes. My guest will be British neuroscientist and researcher Joseph Gibelli, author of the new book In Pursuit of Memory, The Fight Against Alzheimer's. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll hear from the new CEO for Child and Family Service, Karen Tan.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.